I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We know that school districts have trouble finding teachers for every classroom, and part of the problem is fewer people pursuing education degrees. Today, why the drop in the number of students answering the call to teach? With fewer education majors coming out of colleges across the country, two college deans will describe what's being done to bring students to the profession and to graduate teachers more reflective of today's diverse communities. Then, there's work to be done if Kansas City wants to be competitive with similar-sized metropolitans. How one group is on a mission to push KC to a top 10 ranking for prosperity among peer cities. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The headlines are daunting enough. Shortage forces KC area districts to put more unqualified teachers in classrooms. The teacher shortage is real, large and growing, and worse than we thought. Schools have a hard enough time finding enough teachers. Now their source for good candidates is drying up too. Here's a stat for you. The number of undergraduate education degrees awarded every year in this country peaked at almost 200,000 in the early 1970s. Today, it's less than half of that. Now, an update on how schools of education in our part of the country are faring when it comes to attracting students who want to be teachers. With us here, Catherine Cheval is the Dean of the College of Education at the University of Missouri. She joins us from the studios of KBIA in Columbia. Dean, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
David Huff is joining us by phone. He's the Dean of the College of Education at Missouri State University down in Springfield. Dean Huff, good morning to you.
Good morning to you and everyone listening.
You know, Catherine, should anybody be surprised about this shortage? I mean, you read about lousy pay, you read about frustrations with teaching to the test, you read about how difficult the job is, you read about parents who are so dissatisfied with the quality of education their kids are receiving. I mean, who would want the job?
You know, that we have a media issue, I would say, a PR issue with the teaching field. So, it's not a surprise that, you know, for the first time in the history of our country, people that are teachers are advising their own children not to enter the field. So how do we counter those narratives that are out there? You know, one of the things that I often ask is, if you look at the media coverage of teaching, how many positive articles or, you know, radio shows are there compared to negative? And that's a problem for us.
David, how do you fight your way past this, and what do you see happening out there when it comes to the image of teaching?
Well, I agree with Catherine. I think it's a PR issue, although I will say I'm not sure we have really good data on all the reasons why high school graduates are not choosing education as a career. But there are a few bits of information that we do have, and one is back in the day when people became classroom teachers, they tended to stay teachers for a very long time. And today they are leaving in record numbers, either early in their career or the first opportunity they have to retire. So that's creating a demand at the same time as fewer people are choosing to go into education. And we think at Missouri State, a lot of it has to do with the new high school graduate who wants a career, not just a job, but a true career. And then that goes back to what Catherine was saying. We need to market education as a career.
I was going to say, Catherine, does teaching really have a PR problem? Or, in fact, it's a pretty tough job, isn't it?
It's a really tough job. You know, you think about all the challenges that teachers face, and you've already mentioned, you know, the low wages, not having community support, lack of, you know, resources. You see the articles at the beginning of every, you know, every year of teachers have to buy their own school supplies. They have difficult first teaching assignments and advising assignments. You know, it's been interesting in 2019 to see how the press is changing the message. You know, if you look back, you see every fall there were teacher shortage articles, and this year it's about the teacher exodus problem. And so it's pretty interesting to see that people are starting to recognize that we have to address, our communities have to address this problem. And, you know, how much does it cost a community every time a teacher leaves their community as a teacher?
David, I'm just guessing that these are the types of issues that keep people like you up at night.
Well, they are. At Missouri State, we have a new program that we are launching to address it, though. We call it a bear in every building. Catherine, that'd be a tiger in every building for you. But we're reaching out to our 9,000-plus alums who are actually teaching in the public schools across the state of Missouri. There's over 66,000 certificated teachers in our state, and we're asking them to help us change the narrative. Because, again, I think Catherine is spot on in terms of the it's a hard job, and there's a lot of negative media attention on schools, but there's a positive side as well. And, you know, this is a hard sell, but most and across all of our states, the public school retirement systems are wonderful. Now, that's a hard sell to a 22-year-old, you know, to choose education as a career because it's a great retirement. But similar to the military, after 30 years, at age 52, you could retire from teaching and still have many years left to work another job if you wanted to. Plus, the retirement's really good. And people do not choose education to make money in the first place, and salaries are always going to be bad. They need to be raised. That is an issue. But people choose education a lot like people who choose social work. They want to give back to their communities. Mm-hmm. They believe they can help children and families be successful. And so that's why they go into the business of teaching in the first place.
So I'm wondering, Catherine, how these challenges are translating when it comes to seeing, when it comes to your enrollment numbers at the University of Missouri. What's happened in recent years?
Yeah, we're pretty fortunate. We've put a huge effort into this. And so for our opening day enrollment this fall, we had a 37.4% increase over last fall.
37%, Catherine?
37.4%.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's
extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's huge. Yeah. It's really, yeah, because actually deans across the country are asking me to come and talk to them about what we're doing.
I bet they are. Well, how did you do it?
Well, you have to invest in people that do that work, and you have to be out in the high schools talking to young people. And so we've had an incredible recruitment coordinator, who's now director of that office, Brittany Smotherson, and she was willing to go into any high school in Missouri and talk to students. So, and Missouri schools started, you know, opening up their doors to her. And so she traveled the state talking to students. You have to communicate with students. She'll tell you that they have to see themselves in the teaching profession. They, you know, everybody can usually identify their favorite teachers in their life or the teachers that influence them the most.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, they want to have the impact on other people. And so they choose education versus social work or other health industries where you're really working with people.
I gather, Catherine, that a 37% bump, though, that's an aberration at schools of education around the country.
Yes, yes. Based on my conversations with deans across the country, they haven't seen that kind of increase.
David Huff, what are you seeing at Missouri State University when it comes to enrollment?
Well, it's been a mixed bag over the last 7 years for the university. We've had record enrollments every year, while others have been on the decline. And a lot of the reasons for that, we think, is because people think they're getting an affordable degree, a high-quality degree that's affordable. However, this year our enrollments are down at the university, where we had a slight bump in education programs, but over the last 2 or 3 years they have been declining. And you're right, it's a national phenomenon, and I don't think we've been in this situation since post-World War II with the baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's going to have to be some kind of national narrative around this and some national policies and some positive PR to get it turned around. But like Mizzou and other high-quality schools that have great teacher education programs, we are reaching out to the high schools and just through our Bear in Every Building program with our alums, trying to change that narrative and trying to convince people that it really is a good career despite all the negatives.
We're talking about this phenomenon across the country of fewer students wanting to become teachers in our high schools and elementary schools. What's behind that and what needs to change it? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to some phone calls here, and Bob from Lawrence. Bob, good morning. You're on the show.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to both of your guests. I think that it's much more low pay and lack of resources than it is PR, but I've been married to a teacher in the Kansas City metro area who's been teaching for about 30 years, mm-hmm. and the emotional toll, this is not a job that you walk away from at 3:30 or 4:30 or 5:30 when you get done with your day. It's a real emotional investment in the lives of kids who may come from great backgrounds or come from less than great backgrounds. And so, you know, I'm interested in what these two deans are doing as far as preparing prospective teachers to deal with that kind of emotional investment.
What about that emotional toll, Catherine? What do you how do you address that at Mizzou?
Yeah, I mean, this is real. We actually did a study, myself and another colleague in the College of Education, where we interviewed beginning teachers in Missouri, and this was in math and science teachers. And a lot of them talked about, in those interviews, the stress that they felt. And that they needed people that, you know, people and strategies to help them process the stress. So, you know, students are experiencing significant challenges in some of their lives. And, you know, teachers are taking on kind of those emotional hits on a daily basis. If they don't have people to help them process that kind of stress, and a lot of times they said it was family members, it was, you know, colleagues in other schools, but if they didn't have people to call on after a really bad day at the office, you know, they would typically leave the field. Hmm. They would, and so we have to think about induction programs and helping people get apprenticed into this. But we also have to think about, you know, mental health. And so we've built it into our curriculum. We're doing some mentoring programs for our beginning teachers via distance. So we're really trying to think about our curriculum while they're students here, but we have to support them while they're out in the field. And so we've started some new initiatives there, too.
That's interesting. Let's go to Jane from Kansas City, Missouri. Jane, you're on Up to Date.
Hi. I come from a long line of teachers in my family, but I'm in the corporate world where ageism is alive and well.
Yes.
Older people ready for a change who could be amazing teachers and really offer a lot if they thought about reaching out to that demographic.
Yeah, good question, Jane. David Huff from Missouri State. What about reaching out to folks in their 50s and 60s about maybe launching a second career?
You know, we started that program a few years ago at Missouri State. It's a Master of Arts in Teaching certificate program, and it was designed to encourage mid-career professionals to choose education, because a lot of people do have very successful careers in art or journalism. One success story was in chemistry. We had an individual in his mid-50s who retired from Dow Chemical who came to Missouri State to teach chemistry. And that individual ended up going into a very rural Ozark school teaching chemistry. And I'm thinking, wow, how cool is that to be a student in a rural school and have somebody like that? But I think Jane is exactly right. Now, I will say that program that we started about 10 years ago is also on the decline. We have fewer mid-career professionals choosing that. In fact, that program became the second largest graduate program at Missouri State University behind our MBA.
Hmm. Well, Catherine, what about the notion of pay? We've sort of mentioned it, but really haven't addressed it. How big of a concern is that to you as a dean of a college of education here in our state?
Well, Missouri didn't have great press this year with the starting teacher salaries on the national level.
Right.
And so, you know, we're competing with other states for teachers.
What is that starting pay right now?
Oh, it varies quite a bit, considerably.
From district to district, you're
from
saying?
From district to district, yeah. And so it varies considerably. And, you know, and then a large, you know, then little chunks, you know, taxes and retirement. And, you know, you look at student loans these days that students have to pay back. So, so it becomes a challenge. That's why there's been a lot of national press on, you know, teachers taking out second jobs, you know, so they can pay their bills. You know, I think that we're going to have to probably as a society start to have the hard questions about how much are we willing to pay the people that we invest our children to, that spend the most time with our children.
And Catherine, oftentimes, that question's been kicking around for a long time.
Long time. So, but, you know, it's been interesting because when I was in the teacher workforce in the 80s, you know, teachers were looked down upon if they went on a strike, for example. You know, and you can't do that to children. But, you know, with strikes in more than six states and, you know, in recent years, you know, the narrative's even changed on that. And people are like, yeah, I kind of understand it. I'm looking at what teachers make. So we're going to have to start thinking about what do we invest in our teaching workforce so that our communities have the best teachers. I mean, you ask any parent, they want their children going to schools with great teachers, and they think there should be an investment there. So how do we, you know, how do we make sure that that happens? And that's those are going to be some hard, you know, conversations going forward, because you look at the strategies that are happening in this country around how to fill classrooms with bodies that aren't trained, you know, people have to start caring about that issue.
David, in the Springfield area, what could you expect a starting teacher to earn these days, an elementary school teacher?
Well, just in round numbers, about $30,000, but there is quite a wide range. I will say, and, you know, Bob, one of your callers raised this as well. His wife been teaching for 30 years, and salary is an issue. We had a think tank in Springfield this past summer, supported by Doug Pitt's organization, Care to Learn. And really it focused on, as I said, the media attention, bad narrative around teaching, but also on salaries. And, you know, Missouri ranked 48th out of the 50 states. Now, that's not just bad PR. That's just a fact, you know, in terms of starting teacher salaries. And also this last summer in August, our governor mentioned to the administrators at the conference that it would take a $5,000 per teacher increase at a minimum to raise us from 48th to 30th. Among starting salaries across the United States.
And the
nice thing about that is it sounded like he was very supportive of something like that. It sounds like our State Board of Education is supportive. I know we've got leadership throughout the state. It, you know, rather than strikes and those kinds of approaches, I'm kind of guardedly optimistic that this conversation, you know, around the need for teachers and high-quality teachers, and they deserve a living wage and all that, it might just produce something in the next year or two.
You know, Catherine, the other thing you read about is that there are these big issues out there when it comes to the diversity of education majors, or maybe I should say the lack of diversity. In 2018, 52% of students in public schools were projected to be non-white, but only 25% of those earning undergraduate degrees in education were people of color. What are you seeing at Mizzou?
Well, we've initiated a couple different programs to address that. Our school districts are asking us for teachers of color, so they recognize that there's an influence on student achievement. So as the student demographics have changed, our schools want teachers that represent that diversity in their schools. So we started the Dorsey Scholars Program, and in that program, the students are students from first-generation families and underrepresented groups. They're provided a scholarship of $8,000 a year for 4 years. We commit that to them up front as long as they, you know, of course, maintain their GPA. They are in leadership, growth opportunities, academic networks. They're building their professional networks, and donors have been providing those scholarships. Those students are the first students. We just had our first graduating cohort, and they all have jobs. So I have superintendents saying, you know, what's the names of the, you know, everybody wants these kiddos. So so I think we're going to need more initiatives like that, because there are students that want to go into teaching that come from diverse backgrounds. And so how do we make sure that they're successful? And they graduate in 4 years and not with a lot of debt.
David, why is it so tough from your vantage point to convince students of color to go into the teaching profession?
They have a lot of opportunities, actually, in other areas.
And
we actually have a recruiter, Ashley Flores, down in Mobile, Alabama, recruiting students of color for us. And those kids have excellent ACT scores, 21 and higher. In fact, the magic number, you know, if you want to get scholarships is 28, 29, 30 ACTs, and many of these kids have that. And so they're choosing other fields, other careers when they have those options. But again, there is a need. The school districts understand that. They do ask us for teachers of color. And it's not really just that. When you look at elementary teachers, for example, there are not enough men choosing elementary education. They're precious few. And then in the secondary areas is where we really struggle to find persons of color to choose those areas. We graduated a young man last year. He's actually from Mobile, one of our recruits, who's an African American, who is now teaching early childhood special education.
Boy, he hit the sweet spot there, didn't he?
Because you got it. Right.
It's said the greatest need for teachers out there is consistently within the areas of special ed and bilingual education. Why have those areas emerged, Catherine, as the greatest needs for teachers?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that special education, math, and science have always been on the shortage list as fields that really need teachers. I think the second language and the foreign language, that has come up in more recent years when states started putting in place certification in those areas. So I'd even have to look back at the history of when did those certification type programs are initiated in the U.S. or in Missouri. So those are relatively new. And so then whenever, you know, you think about historically, people that are working with those populations are bilingual, you know, and have an interest in developing working in multiple languages. So I think there we've seen the impact of school districts have eliminated content areas at the high school level because they couldn't get teachers. So that's been one of the strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So computer science doesn't exist in 50% of our high schools. Physics doesn't, you know, exist in 50% of our high schools. Foreign language has been eliminated because they couldn't get teachers.
Wow.
So
as
you see these policy implications that happen when people don't know what to do when they don't have teachers. So that eliminating curriculum and courses is one of the approaches.
And you're seeing that, what, across the state of Missouri and across the country?
Those are national statistics. This is a national. So there's been all of this effort most recently. The federal government has started to think about, in the state of Missouri, created standards for computer science teachers, for example. So these are new conversations. I mean, we weren't, you know, you think about how long a field has computer science been out there for schools. So you have federal funding initiatives now for computer science for all initiatives. So that's been a new direction. Coding, you're seeing things about coding for girls or coding for all students. So those are all new things that change the curriculum. But then, you know, universities have to change their programs and be flexible with the teacher workforce when schools develop new needs.
So you can't find a physics teacher, you just eliminate physics. It's just that simple.
That has happened, yeah.
Wow.
Physics is
wow.
huge. In the rural areas, it's 70 to 80% of our rural schools do not offer high school physics.
Yeah. Eric from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on Up to Date, Eric.
Hey, thanks. What would be your best suggestion or route for someone who's a professional with a family who couldn't really take the time out to student teach? I've been in the disability field for 20 years and would love to get into the SPED program, but it seems the emphasis on bringing in new teachers has been on STEM programs. Do you have any ideas?
David?
Well, there has been an emphasis on STEM, but there's also an emphasis on special ed, as I mentioned earlier, early childhood special ed. I talked about the sweet spot there. So, Eric, could I ask if you have a bachelor's degree already?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's degree in psychology and have been working in the disability field, but I've got three kids. Not like I can stop everything and have no income to student teach.
Right. And so the program I mentioned earlier, we have a Master of Arts in Teaching program. It's designed for individuals exactly like you. And what we can do in Missouri is we could get you a provisional teaching certificate if you meet the state qualifications and put you in a classroom after about an 8-week boot camp program where we get you prepared. And you would take some of your classes online. You would earn some of your classes while you're working in a school as a paraprofessional, if you will. And you can do that for 1 year as you're taking courses and earning your certification. There's also post-baccalaureate options with that. Now, I will say that if you can't get that done in 1 year, and most of our students cannot, it will take a second year, and you can renew that position on a temporary basis for a second year. I want to give a shout out to our Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. They work with all of us, all the institutions of higher education across the state of Missouri, in a very good manner to try to make that work. Now, I will say one last thing. Since your bachelor's degree is in psychology and not special education, you may have to take several special education content courses. And if you already had some kind of degree that had those courses, you wouldn't have to do it. But probably with psychology, you would have to take several additional content courses.
We'll have to leave our conversation there. Eric, I hope that helped a little bit. I hope people get a sense of the challenges facing us as we try to get new teachers into the field these days. David Huff joined us this morning, Dean of the College of Education at Missouri State University in Springfield. Catherine Cheval, the Dean of the College of Education at the University of Missouri. Thank you both very much. So good to have you, and thanks for the good conversation.
Thanks so much. And thanks for recognizing the problem facing Missouri. We appreciate it.
You bet. After a break, when we come back, we'll talk about Kansas City's need to keep growing and what's standing in our way. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Kraske Off Mic is my weekly newsletter available at kcur.org/Kraske. There's exclusive content from me and highlights from the entire up-to-date team sent right to your inbox each Monday. You can sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow, young climate activists in Kansas City talk about how they find hope in the midst of a climate crisis and how they're changing their own lives because of the threat. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kansas City can point to growth, but compared with other similar-sized metropolitan areas, prosperity is lagging. KC Rising is a cooperative of business, civic, education, and philanthropic leaders looking to improve our area's economic prospects. The organization wants to push KC into a top 10 ranking among 31 peer cities across the country into a whole host of metrics. They want to do it in three key areas by 2025: gross domestic product, quality jobs, and median household income. There's clearly work to be done. Kansas City's standing is slipping down to 20th in gross domestic product, 13th in quality jobs, and 16th in median household income. How the group plans to do this is now our topic. With us, John Murphy of Shook, Hardy & Bacon is the co-chair of KC Rising. John, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Also with us is Sherry Gonzalez. She's vice president of the Civic Council of Greater Kansas City. Sherry, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, John, nothing like a challenge. How big of a challenge are you looking at here?
Well, it's a challenge, but I think we have some unique
opportunities here.
At a
very macro level, right? I mean, you're really taking on some big things.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we established what we're calling our Horizon Goals, we recognized that these were long-range, for the most part, lagging indicators that we were going to have to deal with. And one of the things, you know, you mentioned that we were lagging behind some of our peers. One thing I think you need to note is that we have been increasing in GDP, in median household income, and quality jobs, just not to the same extent as some of our peer cities.
That's the issue. Yeah. You know, the KC Metro, Sherry, is cleaved in half by the state line. We lack Fortune 500 companies here. We have a good university, but many people agree it needs to be larger, maybe more impactful. And there's a whole lot of mountains to climb out there, right?
Absolutely there are. But what we also know is that there's a whole lot of potential in Kansas City. We've looked at some of our peer metros. Some of the ones that are doing better than us also have similar characteristics. Hmm. And so there's things that they were able to do, just gathering people together in a civic way, having intention and action, collaboration, and setting some common goals that allowed them to be successful. And so we believe Kansas City can also be successful when we get our shared vision sort of articulated and we're working together toward it.
Which of those mountains is the steepest to climb? Is there one that stands out to you?
So we are currently right now in a shared vision process. And so this isn't going to be something that just we select as the steering committee or as staff or as executives within civic organizations. It's actually something that the community has input in. And so we just completed in August a survey, and there were sort of seven themes that came out of that survey of what mattered to people in the community, which were very similar to what we've been talking about at the steering committee. And part of why we're here is because this week and through the rest of this month into October, we're going to be out in the community, and we want folks to come and tell us where they think we should be focusing our effort. And so those are decisions that will be made as a shared vision with the community in mind.
You know, John Murphy, this group formed back in 2014. Why did it come together? What spurred its creation at the time back a few years ago here?
Yeah, back in 2013, there was a recognition by the business community and also the community leaders that we were not coming out of the recession as quickly as some of our peers. So what we decided to do was establish a business-led community effort of about 300 volunteers to work with four sponsoring organizations, the Civic Council, the Greater Kansas City Chamber, the Mid-America Regional Council, and the KCADC. Mm-hmm. Each of those sponsoring organizations brings a certain expertise to the table, but it was going to be a collaborative effort across state lines where we were going to identify gaps that needed to be addressed and align and convene the appropriate parties to deal with those gaps.
You know, why do we need KC Rising? Doesn't the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce do a lot of this work?
I think they do, but each of those sponsoring organizations has certain strengths. But as Doug Girard, one of the first co-chairs of the steering committee, said when we first started this, what KC Rising did was actually brought people to the table to talk that heretofore had not been talking.
Mm.
And I think that's been a major, major accomplishment of KC Rising.
You know, Sherry, the latest numbers suggest that Kansas City still has a long ways to go in the areas that KC Rising is focusing on. So you can't help but wonder, how successful have you guys been?
So as John mentioned earlier, we are actually growing in all of those areas. So what we've sort of diagnosed is that our challenge is a pace issue.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a couple of minutes ago the fragmentation. Yes, the fragmentation is a challenge. And so part of what we're doing is in KC Rising 2.0, we're figuring out how we can align ourselves to help better align the community to address the pace issue, and make sure that we are accelerating the things that matter to this community and to our competitiveness in the economy.
Do other cities have similar groups to KC Rising?
There are many.
Are we unique somehow?
There are many cities that have similar groups to KC Rising. The thing that sort of sets KC Rising apart from many of those initiatives are that this is business-led. Where it originated and who continues to sort of predominantly be at the table is business, and that's important to what we're trying to do in economic development and competitiveness. The other thing that sort of sets us apart is that we're really looking long range. I mean, you mentioned 2025, but that's not when we expect this to end. We expect that this is sort of a 20-year initiative. We have some goals we're working on right now for 2030. And so we're here to stay and really see this change and these metrics improve.
So this is a patience game to some degree.
to some degree it is. But there are things that we can point to that have already occurred. Some of the early initiatives like Casey Rise Fund that is now on its second sort of phase.
What is the Casey Rise Fund?
Casey Rise Fund exists to address the capital issues within Kansas City so we can grow local companies. So it did phase one round funding. Phase two is now out there and they're funding. And that's one of many initiatives. We've done some stuff in the human capital space to really help develop talent locally. And so KC Scholars is one of those things we've partnered with over the years and will continue to. But we think there's some system level things that to reach the acceleration and the pace and the rank that we want, we need to address those system level issues and that will help us.
Steve, if I might touch
Please,
on a
John.
Point Sherry made about the long-range goals. We're now looking and asking people, what does inclusive or shared prosperity look like in the year 2030? Because we want to make sure that when we reach an end goal, it's a goal that we all wanted. For example, you can look at some of the peer cities that we're competing with that on their face maybe are doing very well with these horizon goals, but they don't have inclusive prosperity or shared prosperity. Or you can look at some of these now that have developed huge infrastructure problems. So as we look ahead to the year 2030, we want to make sure that we take measured growth and that we reach a goal that we're all going to be happy with when we get there.
When you say shared prosperity, John, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about inclusive prosperity for all. For example,
across the breadth of the city.
Across the breadth of the city, across the breadth of the region. For example, on October 2nd and 3rd of this year, we're going to have a shared prosperity summit that's bringing to the table a number of diverse entities from around the region that really don't get to get together very often. And we're going to talk about incentives. We're going to talk about entrepreneurship across the board with respect to economic segments of the community.
Yeah. You get a sense that this notion of inclusiveness has reached a certain level here in Kansas City. The focus on it is pretty profound these days.
I think that's true. And it touches so many lives and it touches so many issues. You can't run from the fact that Kansas City has a crime issue. And obviously, there's some legislative things that can be done to address that. But I think more importantly, there's some underpinnings from an economic standpoint that we can start to address. Make every neighborhood a viable neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Give access to people who have jobs. We know that there's regions in this community, or communities in this region, I should say, that have the need for workers. And we know those workers exist in other parts of the region. We have to get a transportation plan where we get those workers to those jobs.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Sherry, your mission here to attack these three metrics, gross domestic product, quality jobs, and median household income, why those three? Why not the number of homicides in Kansas City that John just alluded to?
Well, again, this goes back to this is around an economic imperative that we have. Now, does it matter that we have safe communities and safe neighborhoods to make sure that our economy grows? Yes, it does. And so going back to what we're in a shared vision process right now in Casey Rising 2.0, and one of the conversations is around safe neighborhoods, and it is around affordable housing, and it is around transportation, and mm-hmm. it is around quality education systems. So where we go next and what we focus on next is still to be determined. We're in that process.
We're talking about the work of KC Rising here this morning, a group aimed at dealing with three big metrics, gross domestic product, quality jobs, median household income. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2-way. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's take these one at a time. We're down to 20th in gross domestic product, John. That's the measurement of the total value of goods produced and services provided over the course of a year. What's your thinking on this front as to why we rank 20th of our 31 peer cities?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, with the pure statistics, our growth in GDP is about 5.7%.
Our peer group, which strikes me as pretty healthy.
It is. I think it is healthy, but our peer group is at 12.5%.
12.5%.
Yes. So you can say, yeah, we're doing well, but not well enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the things that obviously has hurt us over the last 15 or 20 years is we've lost some national headquarters,
mm-hmm.
obviously. I think attracting a national headquarter would help. But some of the things that are also taking place is, like, for example, the Casey Rise Fund was mentioned. One of the things that that has as its goal is to not only help entrepreneurs get started,
mm-hmm.
but to make sure once they get started and they're successful, they stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be important as we continue to grow in the region.
Again, one of those issues that's been kicked around town for years and years, the lack of a major Fortune 500 company here in town. Why has that not been so tough for us to crack here in Kansas City?
Well, I think you'd probably have to ask the national headquarters that haven't come here in the past. I think for years, Kansas City was a very well-kept secret. That's changing now.
That's changing.
We have learned that if we get people to come here from a talent standpoint, they stay here. I mean, this is just not anecdotal. We have time and time again, people who come here and tell us that they really didn't have a desire to come to Kansas City, but once they got here, they stayed. The USDA is a classic example of this. We know that when we started off on the USDA, we were probably lagging behind some of the other cities that were making bids. But when they saw what we had to offer, when they saw the talent, when they saw the work ethic, they decided to come.
Yeah. Sherry, what's your sense of why we struggle to attract a major business headquarters here?
I guess I have two responses to that. One is to echo what John has already said.
Right.
I am not originally from Kansas City.
Yeah.
I moved here for a job about 20 years ago, fell in love with the place. This is now my adopted home. This is home to me and where I'm raising my family. And I have a lot of family and friends that have not been here before that came here as a result and went, had no idea. It's a very well-kept secret what mm-hmm. we have to offer, and it's only getting better all the time. In those 20 years, we've changed a lot in Kansas City. I think the other reason is that because there is so much good, and I say this as sort of an outsider who loves this town, there's so much good that we get really comfortable in our good.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard for us to sort of strive for great, or maybe sometimes great scares us because we know of other places that had consequences of their own growth, and we don't want that. We sort of like to keep our good, and we want to stay comfortable in that.
Yeah. I should point out that John Murphy and Sherry Gonzalez will be talking about making Kansas City more competitive. It'll happen at 6:30 tomorrow evening, Tuesday evening, at the Kansas City Public Library Plaza Branch, 4801 Main Street. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. Let's turn now to quality jobs. We rank 13th here, and that's our best score of these three metrics. We're talking here about occupations that require at least a post-secondary degree or certification or pay more than the U.S. median of roughly $44,000 a year. In this area, the Metro has made a concerted effort to focus on engineering, architectural, and life sciences industries. These are our strongest employment sectors. Am I right? This is an area of strength, John?
Absolutely. When we first started Casey Rising in 2014, we had a number of meetings with business leaders around the country, not just in the region, to say, what can we do to grow on our strengths?
And this is an example of doing exactly that, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so what we've been accomplishing in global design and the life sciences bubbled up to the top in that regard. And I think that continues to be two areas where we can not only dominate in the region, not only dominate nationally, but also dominate globally. And people around the country have told us that that is the case. The interesting thing about quality jobs is, as you pointed out, it's not just higher education. It's also jobs that pay better than the national average. And there is a great need for not only college-educated jobs, but also jobs in the trade sectors, where I think we're particularly well-positioned.
You know, one of the things you have talked about very publicly is this idea of raising the minimum wage in this community and across the state. That would help in this area. That's a tough nut politically, though, and I'm wondering, how does Casey Rising take on what has emerged as a fairly controversial political issue in Missouri?
Well, one of the things, rightly or wrongly, we decided to do, that we don't have a legislative or a policy arm to Casey Rising. We basically rely on our sponsoring organizations to be our advocates in the policy area. So that'll be taken on by the chamber, by the Civic Council and to a certain extent by the Mid-America Regional Council. I think it's something that has to be addressed. You're probably referring to an op-ed I did in the Kansas City Star right. several months ago about yes. minimum wage and the fact that a lot of the numbers that are thrown out now for minimum wage are really unrealistic for what a family can expect to do mm-hmm. if they are at the minimum wage level.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, the latest numbers I've seen when it comes to, you know, retaining jobs shows that at least in 2016, about 4,000 more people with bachelor's degrees moved out of Kansas City than moved in. And other years have shown a dramatically different result, Sherry. Any sense of why we saw that outflow in 2016? And has that flipped, changed since then?
So it's flipped.
Has it?
We are now on the net positive end of that.
That's a good thing.
It is a very good thing. And so one of the things to note about that is that those numbers do fluctuate, obviously, right, just from this conversation. So some years it's significant and one in, you know, another. So we're moving in the right direction again, where we're getting net positive. And we are looking at the qualities of place that really help to attract people and then retain people here. Mm-hmm. And we've looked at all of this data in different ways, right? So some of that out-migration is people going out of the metro area for college. Some of it is people in mid-career, mm-hmm. right? And some of it is sort of after they've finished their career. And so we've looked at those as well. And ideally, we want more young people who would come and do that. And we're doing really well in that arena as far as that age range.
You know, John, you know that I also work in higher education, but, you know, there are plenty of critics in both our states who say that one of our big issues here is that the legislature simply aren't investing in higher education at a rate that they need to do it to deal with metrics like the one we're talking about here when it comes to quality jobs. How big of a concern is that to you?
Well, I think it continues to be a concern. And I know earlier today you had a program that touched on some of those issues. I think everybody recognizes it's a need to be addressed, and we're taking steps in that direction. For example, just about 10 days ago, we had over 20 of the region's mayors together to talk about a lot of these issues. And it was really interesting to hear mayors from Missouri and mayors from Kansas of similar-sized cities recognizing that they have similar issues and that the importance of convening together as a regional group of mayors to get some of these things done was very much appreciated.
You know, Sherry, we're 16th in this final metric we're going to talk about here in median household income. How do you assess this one?
So some of that, if you go into our lower metrics, you know, we do have disparity in Kansas City. So part of why we picked median was for a reason, for the inclusive prosperity that John mentioned earlier. So we need to make sure that everyone has economic mobility and opportunity for these quality jobs. That's a part of it. This is also something else, though, where the year to year, those numbers fluctuate. Yeah. And if you go to the data, there's a pretty close clustering of cities. So just as quickly as we went down two ranks, we could go up three or four ranks, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. There's, I think it's a couple $1,000s between some of those ranks. And so it is an area where, yes, we need to address economic mobility and inclusive prosperity, but also we are doing better than some of our peers.
John, is there one of these metrics that's the most important one in your view, gross domestic product or quality jobs or median household income? What's the one that we should all be paying the most attention to?
Well, I think they're all important. If I had to pick one, I think it would be quality jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need to get...
That takes care of the other two.
Yeah,
then, right?
I believe it does. I think we need to get the Kansas City community to work. I know there are people out there that do not have jobs that want to work but can't work because of access or other issues, and we have to solve that issue. You know, when you look at gross domestic product, yeah, I'd like to see that move, but that's almost like an oil tanker in terms of it's very difficult to accomplish very real moves over any length of time.
Yeah. Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there again. John Murphy, Sherry Gonzalez speaking about making Kansas City more competitive, 6:30 Tuesday at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. John, Sherry, thank you both for a good conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Friday on the show, we took a look at a possible economic driver. That was the Missouri Hyperloop, and asked how likely it is if we'll see one along I-70 in the near future. You can find that in other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, climate issues have finally risen to the forefront of the news cycle. We'll find out how young adults in the area have already changed their daily lives because of the threat of global warming. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.